Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. But before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our weekly newsletter, daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us when we go live every 2 p.m. every Thursday. Jeff, welcome back. How you doing?
Good. Thanks to Ben for filling in.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Did you enjoy your time away?
It was good. I was at a cybersecurity conference. It was very interesting. A lot of AI type stuff that I'm sure you wouldn't have liked, David, because they were actually trying to quell a lot of fears that artificial intelligence will not take over the world. So I'm sure you'd have been very disappointed.
That's what they tell you right before it takes over.
I mean, that's the attitude we're trying to stop.
Well, I'm on the opposite end of that.
No, that's why you would not have enjoyed this.
Well, I mean, like, so, I mean, how was the show, like, in terms of have we've solved cybersecurity? Like, it's over now. We don't need to worry about it?
Not even close.
Okay. Have we solved cybersecurity?
Yeah, they all met in Chicago.
Is it done?
Us in Milwaukee. Yeah, all the bad guys are just like, this is hard.
Yeah.
We're done. This is too hard.
You know what?
The greatest.
Oh, so much work.
The greatest minds in cybersecurity descended upon Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Wrapped it right up in like 2 days worth of sessions and cyber is over.
No, because David, there's always people like us who will click on almost anything if it has the right subject line. So that's why we still need lots of cybersecurity people.
I mean, it sounded like a surefire deal. Anna, how are you doing this week?
Doing fine. Having a good time.
Yeah.
Eric's having a good time. I know
everyone's
that.
Everyone's having a good time.
Yeah.
It's amazing how losing internet connectivity the moment before we go live just really seems to like dial up the tension in the studio a little bit.
Eric's excited because we have volleyball tonight and we have an undefeated record so far.
Oh, congratulations.
So that's why Eric's excited.
Right. Pressure's that's on. Right.
Hey, but you know what? 0-0, you know, you just got to go for this one. Or is it 1-0?
No, we're 3-0.
No, but you got to like
back up.
You got to play like just one game at a time. Or what's the saying where it's just like, oh, it doesn't matter what the record is. It's 0-0. You're just going for one win at a time.
Well, you'll get well versed in those as your children enter sports. So. Brush up on all those because they're important.
Oh, I can't. I mean, just gets me going. I can't wait to be the overcompetitive dad. All right. Well, before we jump into our first story this week, a reminder that if you'd like to sponsor the podcast, you can reach Industrial Media President Tom Lynch at tom@IEN.com with sponsor the podcast in the subject line. We'd love to have you on board. Now, a message from this week's sponsor, OEO.
At OEO Energy Solutions, we light your facility. OEO provides commercial and industrial LED lighting solutions and is a specialty supplier of both LED lamps and luminaires. As a leader in plug-and-play technology, OEO has developed the Easy LED lamp, which makes the conversion to LED fast and simple. OEO's direct replacement Easy LED lamps are designed to replace metal halide and high-pressure sodium bulbs. These lamps function with your existing ballasts, so that costly fixture replacement is not required, making your LED upgrade as simple as changing a light bulb. As an added benefit, the Easy LED hybrid technology also works on direct line voltage, providing you ultimate flexibility. OEO's other specialty products include LED fixtures designed for the harshest conditions, including high-temperature manufacturing applications. Whether you're looking for LED lamps, high bay fixtures, office lighting, or outdoor area lighting, OEO has you covered. Contact OEO today for expert guidance on your next lighting project. OEO's knowledgeable team will make sure you have the right light for the right application. For all your lighting needs, visit OEO.com or call 1-800-553-2112. OEO Energy Solutions. Energy savings. Simplified.
And we're back. This week's episode is brought to you by OEO. OEO's direct replacement Easy LED lamps are designed to replace metal halide and high-pressure sodium bulbs. These lamps function with your existing ballasts so that costly fixture replacement is not required, making your LED upgrade as simple as, Jeff?
Changing a light bulb.
There you go. See, he's back. Just didn't miss a stride. Whether you're looking for LED lamps, high bay fixtures, office lighting, or outdoor area lighting, OEO has you covered. OEO Energy Solutions. Energy savings simplified. Our first story this week. Tyson dumping millions of pounds of waste into U.S. waterways. A new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists, a nonprofit organization made up of scientists, analysts, and policy experts, says Tyson Foods has released billions of gallons of wastewater into U.S. waterways. And the wastewater has included some troubling substances, like nitrogen and phosphorus, which can deplete the oxygen in the water, animal byproducts like blood and feces, and pathogens like E. coli. The plants generate a lot of wastewater, washing animals, cleaning meat, sanitizing equipment, and scrubbing work areas. Citing data from the EPA, UCS says that between 2018 and 2022, Tyson generated more than 87 billion gallons of wastewater. UCS used publicly available data from the EPA to estimate the quantity and distribution of Tyson's water discharges. In a five-year period, Tyson's plants dumped more than 371 million pounds of pollutants into U.S. waterways. In a statement provided to IEN, Tyson said it uses a, quote, robust management system to mitigate environmental risks and impact and strives to run operations as responsible stewards of natural resources. The company says it works closely with regulators as it plans, designs, and operates wastewater systems. Tyson also says the report does not acknowledge the company's ongoing compliance with EPA regulations. Even if Tyson is doing its best in terms of wastewater management, Anna, it's still a messy business.
Sure is. I'm glad that, and I'm sure our audience is glad that we started out this podcast nice and light with blood, feces, animal byproducts, waste byproducts.
I skipped the part where it said just general animal parts.
Parts.
I cut that one out. I was like, seems vague to me. But
yeah.
Then, you know, being dialing it in with more specifics, that doesn't seem good either.
Could be any parts in the lake. Yeah, what I didn't hear in Tyson's statement is, no, we did not do this. But we can come back to that. I think, you know, I think we hear a lot of backlash when a plant is proposed and you hear a lot of hesitation from community members, sometimes worse than hesitation. This is why. This stuff like this is why, you know. These are examples of like why people are afraid of what's not being said.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't tell me that when Nebraska residents, so the report talked about the concentration of the discharge and how Nebraska was the recipient of about 30-something percent.
Yeah, 30%. They have the biggest plants in the U.S., and a lot of it's going into Nebraska's water.
Yes. You can't tell me that when Nebraska's residents were faced with the prospect of development or expansion from Tyson, that there was a spokesperson there saying, like, and also, we're going to discharge animal blood and feces and E. coli into your local waterways.
That would raise a red flag.
It's just not being said, right? Mm-hmm. I don't care, but I don't care how like pro business you are here. Like nobody is signing on for that when that's like put out there like that. It just, to me, it kind of muddies the waters, no pun intended, around these discussions about whether or not these are positive investments for a community. And I'd say that generally it's stuff like this that makes people pause. So unfortunately, it's not a good look for manufacturing or food manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, according to the UCS report, research has found that almost 75% of water polluting meat processing facilities are located within 1 mile of communities of, quote, demographic or environmental characteristics of concern. So people who live with more pollution already, less power, worse health compared to other areas of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So they're already sort of marginalized communities. And so, you know, that's disappointing. And I would say like for the crowd that's suggesting that like this is a closed system, this is being described as discharge in some cases pumped directly into lakes, streams and rivers.
Yeah.
But also, you know, water that can carry pollutants all, you know, all these places because of downstream impacts. So, you know, you've got endangered plants, animals, interconnected rivers and streams that drag this stuff all over town. We've all seen the impacts of nitrogen in waterways in Wisconsin, which is like a farming state, and you get the runoff, and then that's why your favorite recreational lake is
it's closed,
covered with blue-green algae half the year because of that stuff. So I don't know. To me, it was just like I don't really care what you say or how, again, how pro-business you are. I don't think corporations have a right to do this.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And one thing that I liked is that UCS also talked about solutions. They didn't just say that, you know, this is the state of it and we're going to have to live with it. They said that, you know, the Biden administration and regulators are working on, you know, making big meat a little bit smaller, right? Mm-hmm. So, Jeff, is the answer getting smaller? Like the USDA working to expand small and medium scale meat and poultry processing in the United States? I understand that that's going to at first be a drop in a bucket, but if we start now, it might grow to something that is a little bit more equitable and manageable in the future. Okay, and but, more expensive.
But that's the thing. How are you going to manage that? How are you going to dictate things to stay smaller? That is totally contrary to the way we'd work when it comes to a capitalist economy.
Mm-hmm.
You well, grow, I mean, you get bigger so that you can, in theory, pass along a less expensive product to mass use. So to try to say, well, we want to have more local and organic meat processors, that's great in theory. That's not what the market is going to respond to. I mean, we talk about this all the time with food prices. We've seen it in the last 2 years, how much, especially stuff like chicken, has gone up at times.
Yeah.
So if you know that things are being, and there's investments being made from an environmental perspective, is that going to make you complain less when chicken goes up to $6 a pound?
Not complain less, but I think people might be more open to managing those expenses. And I kind of use like how people have shifted their spending to buy more organic, more whole foods. And
but those numbers are down.
I mean, but like also the how brown and organic eggs, like grass-fed eggs, like those sales are up. I don't know. I look at that and I think like, okay, people are willing to make that choice.
In a certain economic demographic, yes. Not widespread, no.
I don't know. I think that, and I also think that you can incentivize these small and medium scale meat processors to kind of, you know, we see it in every other industry where you kind of give them a little bit more of a leg up so that way they can be competitive, hopefully until they ramp up and become a little bit more sustainable. I think it is possible.
I don't. I don't. This never has played out. This has never worked this way. Look at craft breweries. What's happened to those? They're owned by bigger breweries.
Yeah.
Okay. That's just the way this plays out. So first of all, I'm just going to say this. I'm not pro-pollution. Okay.
Sounds like what you'd say if you were about to become pro-pollution with what you're going to say.
Anna, I'm not the one who was in favor of chopping down acres and acres of apple trees.
You weren't even here.
I listen. I know.
Jeff.
I know.
Whatever.
Now, okay.
I am always in the loop.
So if there is no end to
Let me make my point,
David.
I'm trying to segue you back to your point. Last week, there was so much. There was no conflict on this podcast. And I guess that's what maybe I bring to the table here.
There was plenty of conflict. Some people thought they cut the trees down too early.
But no. It was just getting along way too much.
It was.
Bring it, Jeff.
Not a welcome change. It was just different. It was just different, you know?
It was not a welcome change.
Yeah,
wow.
No, it was like...
There's some Midwestern passive aggressiveness.
No. It was all good. Now, segueing back to... I mean, okay, so if that is not...
Jeff, you can make your point as soon as I say four more things.
You want to make a point on the orchards? Is that where you're going?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, where do you stand on the orchards?
I am with... Heineken.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, then you just would have been another one agreeing. Like, yep, yeah. They had every right to do it. No, okay, so if this small and medium-sized thing is not sustainable, we have to figure out a way to figure out how these large-scale productions can do it smarter and a little bit more sustainable so that way we're not pouring blood and feces into the water. We can at least agree on that, right?
Okay, so first of all, cleaner is always better.
Oh,
I'm not going to debate that. And yeah. I'm not saying it's great that we're dumping all this stuff into our waterways. What frustrated me with the study, though, is it didn't offer any type of scale. So if we're putting all this stuff into the water, what waterways are we putting this into? We're not dumping this into a singular pond. What's the scale here? Because we know that there is a certain element of EPA regulatory where you can have some of this stuff going into the ponds and waterways because there's a resiliency there. Mm-hmm. Mother Nature does have a way to absorb some of this. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Tyson has a bad history here. in 2018, 2021, they got hit, I think, with $2 and $3 million on two separate occasions for in terms of violating the Clean Water Act. Okay. So they're not exactly the shining beacon of environmental stewardship. Mm-hmm. Not trying to say that either. However, I just wish the study would have offered a little more perspective there, because if they're not breaking laws, and there is an element, what is the, how far over the top are they? Okay. It's easy to say there's 177,000 Olympic pools full of their wastewater. Well, if you've been to a food facility, I'm encouraged by the fact that there is wastewater, because that tells me they're cleaning their product. And more importantly, they're cleaning their equipment. That is extremely important to make sure we don't have these salmonella and E. coli breakouts. Mm-hmm. Now, the second part of that is figuring out how to not transfer all of that stuff into all of our waterways, okay? I'm not saying just have carte blanche and spray it wherever you need to, but there does need to be solutions. And the one thing that we have to look at here is the Food and Beverage Administration, or excuse me, the food and beverage industry is going to spend over $40 billion on wastewater treatment this year alone. Mm-hmm. And that is going to increase by almost 10% for the next decade, or at least it's forecast to. We're going to have a story later on in the podcast that talks about environmental controls and the costs associated with them. I'm not saying we're there. We need to continue getting better, but this industry has come a long way and continues to make huge gains. Mm-hmm. And I think when we present this type of pollution information, if we don't present it in the right context, in terms of they are X percentage over, they are X number of pounds over what should be accepted or what the environment can handle, then this just gets lost in the minutia of data saying whatever you want it to.
Yeah. Well, I think if you kind of look into that, part of it was promising to me in that they create 87 billion, what is it? 87 billion gallons of wastewater. That's what they create. But it was only 371 million pounds of pollutants. So,
but that's, isn't that over 5 years?
I mean, yeah, it's over a 5 year period. Okay. But that's what I was saying is like, when you compare it that way, it's like, all right, there's still a lot going into the water, but when you look at how much they're generating, you know, but that was another thing for me too, is that you need studies like this to kind of keep their feet held to the fire. So that way you're right. They don't wind up with like carte blanche where they're just like, well, no one really said anything. So we started with the hooves and then we just started throwing the whole carcass in the water.
Well, again, that's where it comes, but you have to put it in scale. It has to be in perspective, because when you throw it out in such wild numbers like this, either it becomes too big of a problem that no one has an idea how to come up with a solution, or they don't know where to start. When you do at least put it in perspective of what that means per year or two acceptable limits or how many waterways this is being introduced into, I think that offers then a more scalable process for finding answers, not just saying, hey, we got all this crap we're dumping in the water.
Well, and I would encourage people to go to the study and check it out, because it really did get into that minutia in terms of like how that 371 million pounds broke down and specifically what was going in and what was too high and what was not that big, you know, like all the way down to the 0.01% of mercury that was going into the water as a result. I mean, part of that is when you're trying to sum up, you know, like a multi-thousand word report into a singular post. But I mean, for that, I would recommend to anyone else that's still interested, go to the report and check it out, because they do give you a bit more information on that.
I'd agree.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said. I do think there's value in putting this data out there just so people can look at it and say, okay, well, what are the acceptable limits? Do I agree with that? Is this something that we should be doing differently as a country? Because we've seen that in other industries. We just talked about this with like regulatory issues relating to over-the-counter supplements and how there's a lot of people out there that just don't know that that stuff is not regulated. There's tons of chemicals that are banned in Europe, but we use them here freely. And, you know, I think when people start to develop an understanding of like what is actually taking place, whether or not it's about Tyson or it's about maybe the regulatory structure that's underpinning this situation, I think it's good to talk about that, you know?
Agreed.
And it's these communities that are centrally located to these plants that are taking the brunt of this. So it's not like just because it's spread across a big company that it's spread across the entire United States. It's not.
No, that was another big part of the report. And that we did cover in the story is that it was like six states that really are taking like 90% of this. And so when you have such concentrations like that, I think you need to be really cautious before you wind up potentially hurting a lot of people.
Well, that all, I mean, it all kind of feeds back into, you mentioned the communities where a lot of these plants are located next to. Well, that's not coincidence, right? It's because the labor rates are going to be much lower there because, as we've talked about numerous, numerous times, food companies work on low margins. So they need to cut costs where they can, or they need to control costs where they can. And this all kind of comes in together.
Yeah. I think we can all agree that clean water's good, right? We can all agree on that one. You're not going anti-water?
Jeff's hesitating.
That was the craziest sigh ever. Just like, well, hold on a minute. At what cost? You just, we'll all just drink canned liquid death or whatever it is, and we'll all be fine. All right. No more tap for anyone.
Our next most popular story. Boeing says workers falsified 787 inspection records. On Monday, the FAA said it has opened another investigation into Boeing after the company reported that workers at a South Carolina plant falsified inspection records on 787 planes. However, to ease the tension, Boeing engineers said that the misconduct didn't create, quote, an immediate safety of flight issue. The issue came to light after a worker saw a, quote, irregularity in a required test of the wing-to-body join and told his manager. The test confirms adequate bonding and grounding where the wings join the fuselage. So, important. It turns out that multiple workers had violated company policies by skipping these tests. After Boeing told the FAA, they promised to take, quote, swift and serious corrective action with the employees. No planes were taken out of service, but Boeing has to go back and perform the tests on these planes that haven't yet hit the market, which is going to slow deliveries. The company is also going to create a plan to address planes that are currently in service. Well, Anna, at least Boeing did the right thing this time, but is it because the plane maker is out of goodwill?
I mean, clearly they cannot afford another whistleblower scandal.
Yeah.
That just cannot happen. So, it makes sense that this had to come to light and there's no way around it. To me, it like begs the question of why, like why this is happening. You know, you think like, is the inspection process, is it imperfect? Is it too time consuming? Is it set up to fail? Is it cumbersome? You know, like that's what typically happens in a workaround like this, where people are like, well, we're falsifying test results because we don't have time to complete the process before it's got to get out the door or whatever. Or, you know,
maybe because it's redundant and they've already done something like similar, right? On the other side of that.
I mean, honestly, maybe, but like, if that's also a colossal problem, if they're just going rogue and deciding that and no one, you know what I mean? And, you know, I doubt that it's because nobody cares. I just don't think that that's common. But what is driving this? It's very confusing. So Stocker said, as you mentioned, that the company was going to take swift action to address the workers' conduct. It's not just like one rogue worker. This is like multiple workers, as they've indicated.
Yeah.
They're going to use the incident to encourage employees to be alert and report anything that they think is unusual. Quote, it's critical that everyone of us speak up when we see something that may not look right or that needs attention. Words you have to say when you have drama around many whistleblowers dominating the coverage of your company.
Mm-hmm.
For an alternative perspective, industry news site Aviation Week said that the incident provides evidence that Boeing's emphasis on spotlighting safety issues, even if they reflect poorly on the company, is paying dividend. I thought that was a very charitable way of looking at this. But the report went on to add that it also underscores how the company has, has really far to go, as, you know, falsification is really like the worst thing that you can do, the most egregious, like non-operational regulatory violation here. So to me, it's the latter that people are going to take away from this. It may point to some improvements on QA or transparency. But I think that's a little bit of a reach. I don't think people are going to be like, well, hey, at least you figured it out. At least you let us know. I'm happy that you're being honest with us. Like, I think it's more of a like, whoa, can this safety culture be fixed? Like, that's the way every time another thing happens, that's the way I look at it. It just like, how tangled up and gnarled and knotty and horrible is the safety culture, and can it be undone?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're not just talking about this point in time. We're talking about years and years back, where obviously we've talked about this in the past, but the plane crashes and the problems that were associated with that. And all of the people who've spoken out against Boeing's processes and their rush to market and skipping steps, and it just, there's a lot to untangle here. And I don't see that there's really a good way to, like, to look at this. And unfortunately for Boeing, like, a phrase I use a lot, unfortunately for Boeing, this news broke, like, almost at the exact same time as they had to strike a launch that they had planned for a crewed space flight because of a rocket valve problem, which was, like, going to be maybe an anticipated bright point in their, you know, the narrative around Boeing in the last couple of weeks. And they did not get...
You could spin that. Like, they, that? You know, Starliner didn't launch, but that was because someone found out that it was like a single valve that had run too many cycles. So you could say that their improvements in safety culture are what caused the launch to be stopped. You could say that.
You could say
that. That's something you could say. I guess in response to that, I think that any culture is fixable, right? And if anything, we've kind of seen that Boeing's rank and file want to be fixed. They want it fixed. There have been so many people that have spoken out about it that, like, maybe they were so fed up and maybe they're surprised that it took so long. But I feel like Boeing is a company that a lot of people are rooting for internally and externally. The country kind of needs. And so I think, like, there are a lot of people that want it to right the ship. And it's just going to be a matter of what they need to do organizationally to kind of embrace that, rather than just, like, finally start accepting the criticism of potential whistleblowers. Just because I think now more than ever, Boeing employees feel particularly empowered to get out and speak their mind in public. Just like, I mean, maybe that was something that until the first two or three actually put themselves out there, like, nobody was really willing to say something, you know, with their face and their voice blurred and distorted. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, maybe they're feeling a little bit more like they can put themselves out there. Jeff, I guess I'll ask you the same question. Do you think this culture is fixable?
I would disagree with you when you say every culture is fixable. I think this one is big enough, like, and broad enough that you probably can find the problem children and weed them out, so to speak.
Yeah.
But riddle me this, Batman. If you don't do an inspection, okay, that means you didn't look at the thing that wasn't working right. How can you say it didn't create an immediate safety of flight issue?
I know.
How can you even say that?
Hopefully, because it's redundant in some way. Hopefully it's a test that you have to do before another test that would otherwise prove it flight worthy.
I hope you're right about
You've had planes fall out of the sky, man. I mean, how can – I understand. I'm not arguing with you.
No.
How can you make that statement? And how to try to use redundancy as some – I mean, this just blew me away. I mean, reading this, what you really want to do, as opposed to digging in and trying to find, like, critical topics, you just want to go off on Boeing. Like, what more does it take?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, is there any goodwill? No.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say you're rooting for Boeing, and I understand as far as, like, commercial space flight and things like that they're doing in other areas. I want them to be a viable defense contractor. We're going to talk about that in a little bit too. Mm-hmm. But I'm done. Like, there is, like, what more can you do here, especially when it's not an actual mistake? It was just, we didn't feel like doing it today.
Just neglect, yeah.
I mean, that's horrible. This comes to a point in the FAA, just like OSHA can turn things over to the DOJ in terms of prosecuting people. Mm-hmm. So can the FAA. And you kind of wonder what more it's going to take, especially in a situation like this, to not look at either the managers, the employees, or somebody and say, you had somebody's life in your hands. That's mm-hmm. what you do when you get on a plane. Mm-hmm. How can you just overlook that? It's mind-blowing.
So part of that, to me, I'm wondering if the FAA isn't flexing all of its might at the moment because they might be quite exposed here as well, in terms of what they let take place. And I think until that comes to light, we all might be proceeding a little bit more delicately until, that's my own personal instinct. Just seeing how, like, normally the FAA can, like, really come down on people. We talked about when these first stories first started to break, the one thing we talked about was how closely tied together Boeing was with the FAA and how that was likely going to be a problem.
Well, I think another factor here, and we haven't talked about this a ton, but Boeing has a huge union contract that expires, I believe it's September 12th. Okay. Yeah. And it is everybody. It's with their IAMAW union. Yeah. So you can also see why they may be a little bit worried about how they're responding to employees, even when they screw something up on this level.
Yeah.
Because you'd almost expect some sort of greater fallout. But when you've got 30,000 people in this union that you need to negotiate a deal with in the next couple of months, and you've got all of these issues, this is the team you have to work with, right? You're mm-hmm. kind of stuck with them. That it may also be why you're not seeing as much internally from Boeing in terms of maybe cracking down or trying to really do more to help make these employees improve. Because I think you're at a point where it's no longer about improvement. It's like you got to fix it or get out.
Yeah. Well, and do something drastic internally to, you know, make the employees feel empowered to air these grievances internally and get ahead of it. You know, like so that way you're not like putting out these fires individually. So, Jeff, which ones aren't fixable?
Which like in the room?
No, no. No. I guess like maybe if you have a smaller company or something like that, maybe it's not entirely fixable. But I do think that like there are cultures that are bad that, you know, and sometimes it only takes a couple of small changes to right the ship.
So the best analogy for me personally that I could look at would be in the Army.
Okay.
And we had a way of kind of looking at folks and if they are motivated and able. It's sort of the different factors there. Your highest achievers are going to be those who are able and motivated. Mm-hmm. You'll always work with those who are motivated, but maybe are unable at the moment. But if you find somebody who is unmotivated and unable, that's where you cut ties.
Yeah. Well, that's – so you're saying if we had an entire company full of unmotivated and unable?
If they can't do the job and they have no interest in doing it better, yeah that you can't fix.
No, I agree. Like I think when I talk about any company is fixable or any culture is fixable, that is also addition by subtraction playing into that as well. Anna, do you have any companies that come to mind when you think of companies that are not fixable?
No, I mean, like, even the DMV is better now. Like, I don't know. I mean.
They just got in there and they were like, you know what? It's time to make some changes. It's been since we were founded.
We got
to
shake this reputation. And yeah. They did.
Yeah. Now they're bringing out snazzy new plates.
Yeah. You know. Can do stuff online.
Yeah.
It's nice.
So much easier. All right. Well, our next most popular story this week, Tesla laid off its entire EV charging division. And other automakers are worried. Nearly every automaker selling EVs in the United States has signed up to join Tesla's supercharger network. So, many were troubled when Elon Musk laid off the department responsible for Tesla's EV chargers. Last Monday night, about 500 members of Tesla's supercharger team lost their jobs. Now, car makers kind of want to know how a charging network is going to work with no staff to support it, like when new cars are needed to be added to it. Tesla won big when it opened up the network. It's a new revenue stream that includes EV owners, regardless of the make and model. Musk says Tesla will continue to add to this supercharger network, but at a much slower pace for new locations and more focus on 100% uptime and expansion of existing locations. So, Jeff, is it a sign of deeper trouble at Tesla that the company would put its fledgling network at such a risk?
So I'll continue with being consistently inconsistent on my thoughts on Elon Musk because he's kind of all over the board. So when you look at it from one perspective in terms of you need to make cost cuts, if you want to look at Tesla as, hey, we're an automotive company. We're not a real estate company. We're not a development company.
Or a utility.
We make cars.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate when you look at it from a cost-cutting perspective saying this is not a core area of our business. Maybe we don't want to be in the charging business to begin with. It was more of a complementary offering, but maybe he's looking to pull back there, which I can appreciate. I can see that from a business perspective. I think potentially it's a big miss, though. I really do. And this is coming from, again, I've been critical of him saying he's too diverse, going in too many directions. And I'm saying, stay diverse a little bit. So I understand. But I think he's putting a lot of putting a lot into the fact that they've increased the mileage, or the range so much on vehicles. You know, I was looking at something between 2012 and 2021. The range went from an average of 265 to 412 miles between charges. It's a huge gain. They're going to continue to bank on improving that, getting up over that 500-mile range. So he is probably seeing that as well. However, I think in the meantime, as soon as this announcement came out, you know there was some VC out there going, this is interesting now. Now I'm not necessarily fighting Tesla and GM and Ford and Toyota for these charging stations. Maybe I can get behind some of these more fledgling developments, because there are some out there definitely who are trying to run this as a business. So I think he may have created some competition here. Plus, if you're Ford, GM, Toyota, all those other folks, now you're not forced to just work with Tesla potentially. If you've all got the same adapter, same connector, which I think has been universally adapted at this point.
Almost.
You've got more options is what I'm saying. So I think he kind of had an opportunity here to really, really become the only game in town, and he's easing back on that. I get why, but I think it's a miss.
Do you think he might be trying to spin off this part of the business into more of a like utility, you know, a utility business?
Well, unfortunately, so I'll answer your question with a question. But do you think he just wants to get out of this? Like, is this a way of, is he just trying to get away from this part of the business altogether? Because that's what it feels like to me. He said he's going to slow it down.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like Elon Musk. He has never said that before. Like, we're going to take a step back and reevaluate.
Yeah. What it sounds like to me personally is when I read this, I thought, okay, he won to get everyone on his network. Now, if he pairs back, he has automakers and regulators pot committed. So he thinks that he'll get funding outside of Tesla.
Okay.
So I think, I don't know. That was just my personal take, is that, you know, he's never been one to shy away from a government subsidy or loan. And so just like, hey, you know what? We're making the cars and we have the network, but we can't support the network. And if you want the cars, you need the network. So someone's got to pay for it. Yeah. That was my take. Anna, do you have similar thoughts in terms of why he may have scaled back on this? You know, do you agree with Jeff, like in terms of focusing on core competencies at Tesla?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with that in a sense. I mean, you know, you can see how this part of the business, if you're trying to view it as a profit center, could be a bit, like, I would say, unpredictable and murky. And that's because, okay, so if you look at the data on this, like, 80%, this is from the DOE, but 80% of EV charging happens at home. Mm-hmm. So think about that. With ICE vehicles, you can kind of extrapolate to some degree, like, gasoline demand from vehicles on the road. With EVs, the demand correlation is electricity. It's not necessarily public charging. Mm-hmm. And while I think people want it to be there, it's not something that EV drivers are always using for their, you know, their daily miles like you would a gas station. It's just there's less demand for it in reality. And not to mention the fact that the EV share market is like 8% of vehicles on the road. So it's sort of, you know, it's cheaper to charge at home. So, you know, people, for the aforementioned reasons, like the fast charging infrastructure is expensive. It's expensive to maintain. It's probably a massive hassle for him. Mm-hmm. However, I don't know if I agree with your spinoff idea, because this is hardly a done deal with these other automakers. Like, they have agreed to produce an adapter to allow EVs to charge at the Tesla charging stations. A lot of people don't have those adapters yet.
Yeah.
It's not like EVs from these other automakers don't have other options of where to charge. It's just that Tesla has the most already out in the market.
Yeah.
So if he wants to sell these stations to somebody else and everybody just proceeds as planned, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why you strip down that entirely before you would put that up for sale. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, that was the one for me. Like, have you ever heard of any software or any hardware ever working as designed indefinitely?
Well, and you know, already there's like, you know, people complain constantly about public EV chargers and how unreliable they are. And, you know, some, if they go down then and you're there and you can't, you know, so I don't know. So obviously I get it that like, this is a hard part of the business to be in, but at the same time, like, I do think it's a terrible business decision to like get out of this area to make these cuts. I mean, people are wary enough about EVs. Last I checked, Tesla needs to sell more cars. I think that's what needs to take place here. Yeah. And like, whether you mean to or not, with this decision, I think you really needle at the biggest fear of prospective EV drivers. I think a lot of existing EV drivers, they don't have the range anxiety that people who have not like gotten there yet in their brain. Those are the people with the range anxiety. You know, I know plenty of people who have electric cars who have it all figured out, you know, they're not worried at all. They, you know, and, but for people who haven't, that is a massive impediment. And those are the people that you need to sell cars to.
Yeah.
So if you like exploit that fear and you give them a reason to believe that public infrastructure is going to be unreliable or unavailable, like, you know, you give people this like vision that they're going to get bricked on the highway somewhere. Like, that is a really bad way to sell cars.
Yeah.
I feel like it was a perplexing decision whether or not it's an expensive area to be. It's an area that they every automaker needs to be investing in this infrastructure because it's a security blanket for people, you know?
So to that point, do you think it could have been more calculated where he knows that? And as a result, he's just like cutting it all because he knows money will come in from other channels to support it.
Someone else will pick up the pace.
Well, if someone else, and maybe not private, but like in terms of government funding, just in terms of it being so necessary.
I mean, maybe, but like you really, it's a really big gamble.
We're talking about though. Like,
it just seems
the biggest gambler out there.
It just seems so out of character for him to give somebody else that type of opportunity.
See, I don't see it as him giving anyone else the opportunity. I think he thinks he's won this already. He's made it essential, and as a result, it'll be supported as an essential business. That's how I see it. And also, I mean, to the point, like, We talked so many times about how Tesla kept cutting costs and cutting costs. Like, you can only have so many loss leaders in your company. You gotta have money coming in somewhere. The other part of this is the ripple effect that it's going to have, not just for automakers. I pulled out the one quote from Andres Pinter. He's the co-CEO of Bullet EV Charging Solutions. They're an Austin-based EV charge point installer, so they work on Tesla's network. He told Reuters, quote, as contractors for the supercharger network, my team woke up to a sharp kick in the pants this morning. Just, I think a lot of times you don't think of like all the workers that were kind of supporting this network and infrastructure already that kind of woke up last Monday and they were like, so do we go in today or what are we going to do? Other people tease that it could loosen, to your point, Jeff, Tesla's, quote, stranglehold on charging. My biggest question was like everybody else, like, does anybody want it? You know, and I like how you say maybe you could see like a venture capitalist out there just being like, okay, real opportunity. But I don't know.
I think there's definitely interest in it.
So. Okay. Well, our next most popular story. Beer maker to be fined daily over rotten egg smell. For nearly 10 years, residents in La Crosse, Wisconsin have smelled rotten eggs. But the problem wasn't rancid yolks. Instead, it was bad beer. Specifically, a leak in a containment vessel in the City Brewing Company's bioreactor that has been belching hydrogen sulfide into the air. Plant manager Matthew Sweet told the Wisconsin State Journal that City Brewing has been working on a fix for nearly 3 years. But turnover has caused the project to stall. The plant manager says it will likely take a month just to get a firm plan in place, and the beer makers have already spent more than $1 million on repair efforts. The company will likely need to replace the entire wastewater facility. Now, why is all this important? Well, local officials have had enough of the excuses and recently fast-tracked a new compliance order to fine City Brewing $100 per day until the stink is stopped. The company will only be fined until they come up with a proper repair plan, which, as Sweet said, will take at least a month. Anna, as we all have some sort of connection to La Crosse, but it's crazy how this part of Wisconsin has just become synonymous and almost embraced this smell as part of the community because it like ties back to its roots as the original brewery for old style beer.
Yeah. As you said, we, you know, a lot of us have ties to this community. I know you went to college there in La Crosse. Mm-hmm. My family is from there. I still have a lot of family there. I have family who worked at this brewery. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was the first thing I thought of was like, oh God, they got to figure this out. I mean, they employ a lot of people. La Crosse is a university, of course, but it's really like a blue collar town at heart. And like, it doesn't, there's a lot of business that has not survived over the years, you know? So it's like, they need to hang on to these like cornerstone industries and keep these viable. And I think they employ something like 500-600 people at this time. Mm-hmm. So nothing to sneeze at in a town the size of La Crosse. But, you know, you mentioned turnover. I took a peek at their website and I learned that City Brewery in La Crosse has dozens of open job postings currently, which means more than likely that they're experiencing some shortages at this specific plant. What stood out most was there is a vacancy posted for wastewater treatment plant operator.
Ooh, got to fill that one. Top of the heap.
Yeah, with references to the role operating effluent odor control equipment and automatic samplers. Seems relevant. I think it's going to take more than a month.
Yeah.
And I think $100 a day is a joke. I think that is like a, we are doing this in, because...
That's to make news.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We're doing this to like make it clear that we want you to fix this, but we're not going to provide something that's going to be an impediment to you to continue to operate.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not threatening to shut the place down.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, looking at the job board further, the plant is seeking supervisors and managers in production, batching, procurement, warehouse, like goes on and speaks to, I think, the immense gaps that come with the workforce challenges that are facing this industry. Because mm-hmm. it's not like we're hiring a few people for the line.
Yeah.
We need a secretary in the office to answer the phone. I mean, like.
They need people everywhere.
Production manager, batch, procurement manager, warehouse, like supervisor. Like these are big roles and they're all vacant. So, it's concerning. And if you look at their website too, City Brewery has like a very detailed, page that speaks to their manufacturing capabilities, all of their really high tech equipment that they have in place, the process that they use. It provides very specific process details, and QA and things like that. So to me, it's like for a company like that, who has a very transparent and dedicated process in place, this workforce issue is to me like, I mean, that's why a company like that can't get its arms around an odor problem.
Yeah.
And why remediation on this is taking so long to address. So when he says that it's a turnover problem, I truly 100% believe that to be the case.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just, I think it speaks to like the gravity of that problem. We hear it all the time. Manufacturing is facing a talent shortage. We're, you know, X millions of jobs in the next 10 years if we don't do anything now. But like, you know, back to your point about like when the numbers are so big, it feels like this is an insurmountable problem. What do we do about it? People kind of shut down. Mm-hmm. But these are the ramifications, you know, like there's just or the person getting a hand crushed because nobody is there who knows how to do lockout tagout or, you know, it just the list goes on and on. We cover it every single week. And it's just it's crazy to see the kind of stuff that is seeming to me as an absolute direct result of that.
Yeah. For me, it was wild to hear that they've already spent $1 million on the problem and are still at square one. Mm-hmm. But then you realize how they haven't been able to keep people like in that position for more than 3 months at a time. And you understand how you could probably burn through cash pretty quick.
Yeah.
Do you think part of the turnover and labor issues they're running into is that there's no real brands associated with City Brewing? Just because, so one thing I was thinking of is that, you know, you talk about them listing their capabilities, right? They can make up to 16 different beers daily, 1,100 barrels each, giving it an annual yield of 7 million barrels of beer capacity-wise, right? But they're only brewing for contract brewing customers. You know, they don't have any of their own brands that they do anymore. And I was wondering if that was part of the reason that, like, there's not as much employee buy-in. Just because when I think of, this is mostly on the craft brewing part, but it's also on some of the larger domestic brewing operations, that there's, like, some fierce employee loyalty when it comes to like, I'm supporting, you know, Bud Light, I'm supporting mm-hmm. Delta Beer. And I was wondering if part of it is because they're like a contract brewing operation that maybe there's not as much loyalty to the operation.
I mean, maybe, but like to me, that's a problem easily solved with company culture. Like you can make a workplace, you know, function and people want to stay if you position it right. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of weird industries that aren't like exciting, but yeah. That doesn't mean that they hemorrhage people just for that reason. Yeah. You have to be able to like manage that group and make sure that you have an environment that people want to stay in. How do you do that? There's got to be something else going on there.
Yeah, there was I was actually just interviewing a guy in finance today, and I'm like, how do you manage to not have as much turnover? And he was just like, we're cool. So City Brewing just needs to be cooler, be right, cool. Jeff?
Well, I think it is interesting. You guys have talked it through very well in terms of, you know, the gap that they're having there in terms of bringing labor in and stuff like that. I think it was interesting. This is one of the first times I've heard a company be so transparent about it.
Yeah.
Typically, that's something you have to kind of dive into and look at. And they were saying, no, this is one of the leading factors. A couple of things that came to mind here is growing up, Juneau was right next to where I grew up, Juneau, Wisconsin, and they had a yeast production facility. Mm. Now, it wasn't when they were making it. It was either when they were transporting it or cooking it or doing something. But it was like 1 or 2 days a week. It was rough.
Yeah.
If you were anywhere within 10 miles of that plant, you could smell the yeast. It was nasty. But I think there was a sort of a feeling within that community of, well, it's what it is.
Yeah, we're a yeast town.
We're just going to deal with it. And I think that is gone. I think that's gone in terms of constituents within the community, people working within the facility, all of that. And that's a social change that we're seeing played out here, I think, very strongly. I think when you look at lacrosse and this type of position, I think the business model, and you referenced no specific brands,
yeah,
could be part of it. I think part of it, though, is when you look at the brands that are brewed here, and I don't mean this in a negative way, they're not necessarily premium brands. Oh, they're less expensive beers typically.
They embrace that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And like I said, that there's nothing wrong. I love Pabst. I've drank Old Style. I think Lone Star is another one that's attached to them. But what that does then, again, not to beat this up, but it lowers your margins too. When you're not selling a premium product, the margins become more tight and you look at any type of investment more thoroughly than maybe you would otherwise. Mm-hmm. That's not just equipment, that's also people. So you could see some of the issues there being, again, with this type of product in this geography. I mean, some people love lacrosse. I'm sure I've been there a couple of times.
Yeah.
It's nice, but may not be able to recruit the talent you want if you're competing with the Twin Cities or other areas around there.
Yeah.
So you could see just a number of these factors sort of coming together in terms of getting the right people, being able to make the investments you need more quickly in equipment to sort of solve this problem. And then again, you've got a community that maybe for a long time was like, we're fine with this. And this all of a sudden, no.
Yeah. Well, and it's, it used to be when it was more all domestic beer, right? It was like, okay, you could work in the cities, you could work in Milwaukee, you could work in St. Louis, or you could work in lacrosse, right? But as craft brewing has taken off, you can kind of make beer anywhere.
True.
Anywhere. And sometimes, you know, having lived in lacrosse for 4 years, like it can be a hard sell to get people to stay there because, you know, it's great on the outside looking in. And then you're there and you're like, I love it for 4 years and then time to move on. When you talk about the loyalty of the yeast plant, though, that was wild to me because when you talk to people who are from lacrosse, they believe this smell is still from the krausening. The krausening production system, right? So that was the quote old style of carbonization that it used double fermentation method to make the bubbles, right? The krausening method took longer than forced carbonation, which people call like fake carbonation, and also gives it a more mature flavor.
What does that mean?
Well, it means like, so basically you can make cheap beer taste like better beer using this system.
Okay.
But when Pabst bought Old Style in 1999, they're like, we're not doing krausening because it takes too long and it's mm-hmm. inefficient. And they're going to go to this forced carbonation method. But everyone in lacrosse still thinks that this stink is coming from krausening, even though they haven't done it forever, like in like 30 years.
Is that the right pronunciation?
Oh, I don't know.
I always heard Kreuzning.
Kreuzning.
I don't know if it matters.
I mean, that's right. Krausening. I mean, the only reason I'm calling it that is because I had a Professor Krauss in high school. That's all I've got for you there. Kreuzning.
Well, all I can say is having drank Pabst before and after this, the acquisition and the change in breweries, it tastes better now.
It does taste better now?
We tried drinking it in college because that's when they were still brewing Pabst in Milwaukee and we were going to save some jobs. It was rough. It's a lot smoother now. So whatever change they made, it was for the better.
Oh, yeah, you're definitely right. Sorry, Kreuzening aficionados out there. I apologize. That's my bad. That's my Kreuzening cross to bear. All right. Our most popular story this week. Air Force awards $13 billion for new fleet of doomsday planes. Well, another podcast, another story of Boeing being passed over from massive defense contract. The Air Force needs to replace its aging fleet of Boeing E-4B Night Watch aircraft, also known as Doomsday Planes. However, when selection time came, the service picked Sierra Nevada, a 60-year-old aerospace company based in Nevada. Sierra Nevada landed a $13 billion contract that runs through July 2036. The Night Watch is a militarized version of a Boeing 747-200. It's a four-engine aircraft capable of refueling mid-flight. According to the Air Force, it's called kind of a doomsday plane because in case of a national emergency or destruction of ground command and control servers, the aircraft provides a highly survivable command, control, and communications center to direct U.S. forces, execute emergency war orders, and coordinate actions by civil authorities. Sierra has been preparing for this moment. According to Aviation Week, the company last year opened a 90,000-square-foot maintenance, repair, and overhaul hangar, one of four that the company has planned. The company is also opening a 120,000-square-foot paint facility, and the initial deal calls for 8 to 10 planes, but that could grow as the Air Force is currently being pressured to bring back a program that keeps nuclear command posts in the air at all times. While on the outside looking in, Boeing is kind of still in okay shape because the Boeing 747 is still the top candidate for replacing the current fleet of Night Watch aircraft. So, Anna, not all bad for Boeing on this one, just as long as they pick that Boeing 747.
Yeah, which maybe.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you alluded to this another week, another story about Boeing. So for those of you who were listening last week, we discussed Boeing being passed over when the Air Force made selections for its combat drone program.
Yeah.
And, I think that it's easy to like start lumping these together, although I do believe that this contract was a little bit unique and the issues that were possibly influencing the drone contract scenario, I think, are different than this. Mm-hmm. For example, as the article points out, Boeing did reveal that it was eliminated from the bidding back in December. But the report suggests that Boeing was actually heavily influential in that decision because of the tenor of those negotiations. So experts believe that the Air Force One replacement project is at the root of this. Read about what a disaster this has been for Boeing, that the company has undergone like immense timeline and cost overruns to the tune of like $1 billion on those planes, trying to produce the replacement Air Force Ones. So it was reported by Reuters that it was because of that debacle that Boeing has essentially refused to engage in any kind of like fixed price deal where the company is going to be on the hook for cost overruns.
Okay.
They don't want to be locked into paying for that stuff. And so in December, when this was all kind of going down, Boeing did say, like, we are approaching all new contract opportunities with added discipline. And I think it was at that time that they were removed from contention because they were unwilling to take on those terms.
Okay.
So, you know, you mentioned the 747. We don't know a lot right now about the Night Watch replacement, right? But I think that's because the program is pretty classified at this point. So there's still a lot that they're not sharing. There's a lot that's still in development. But, you know, as you said, it was speculated that potentially the program will use 747-8i for the contract. So, you know, maybe Boeing doesn't exactly get to have their cake and eat it too, but maybe they get a bite.
Yeah.
I don't know. Jeff, I know you had more to say about this, about their potential involvement in this.
Yeah. So Jeff, is it kind of the right way, you know, Boeing finally making maybe a little bit better financial decision that kind of pulled them out of this? And is it, I don't know, how do you see that?
I think the DoD going with Boeing on something right now would look really bad.
Yeah.
That's what I said last week. I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think it's like just bad optics. I don't think they want to make that announcement.
Yeah. So, I mean, to that point then, do you think, I mean, do you see them using an Airbus instead of Boeing for this?
I think they could.
Yeah.
I really do. And I think this could be a way of the government sort of stepping in here without officially stepping in or making a move. Because when we get so used to that phrase, too big to fail, which, you know, kind of makes everybody gag right now. But Boeing, with everything that they are involved with on a national level, they do feel like that. Mm-hmm. So how do you get them to like look internally and figure it out without putting some sort of penalty on them? Because you can't really, you can't penalize somebody for just being bad.
Yeah.
So I think this is a way, especially when you look at what Sierra Nevada does in their history. In addition to these planes, I mean, they do some pretty interesting technical electrical work. They do a lot of the cybersecurity upgrades for a lot of the other more advanced technological aircraft. They did the upgrades on the C-130, which everybody's familiar with that. That's a huge mobility asset for the Air Force in terms of people, equipment, vehicles. If you're hauling it someplace for a long distance, you're using a C-130. Mm-hmm. So with that kind of background, you could see this as a way of saying, we've got somebody who knows how to upgrade them. Granted, they don't build planes, but they know how to tear them apart and put them back together. Mm-hmm. Boeing, get your house in order because we have other options here. Okay. Sierra Nevada has no ties to Boeing other than they've worked with them in the past. Okay. Yeah. So I think this could definitely be a way of sort of directly, indirectly putting a lot of pressure on Boeing and showing them that there's a lot of other people that they can work with. And maybe they're not as pigeonholed as we thought they were.
So let's take the 2024 lens off of this thing, right? Where it's December and Boeing has kind of drawn a hard line in the sand because they don't want to sign on for another program that's going to cost them billions. Without the 2024 lens, this is a good move for Boeing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, no question. These are, they need to be putting these strictures on these deals to begin with. I mean, they can't, like, they've been losing money on defense for, you know, how many, a couple of years in a row. That you can't do that forever, you know? And so it's good that they're taking these one at a time and saying, like, we need to figure out a way for us to be able to not fully shoulder the burden of overruns, because there's always overruns.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully they can get their house in order, Jeff. So that way that 747 is maybe a little bit more sound when it comes to specifying those 8 to 10 planes.
Well, especially when you're looking at everything, it seems like from the outside looking in, it seems like it's because it was rushed. They were not taking the amount of time. There was deadline stress and burdens placed on the whole manufacturing operation. Yeah, anything that takes it off their plate, you'd think would be a positive.
I mean, that's not a bad thing to think about, just in terms of like, hey, you know what? Maybe it's time to block and tackle a little bit more, Jeff. Maybe Boeing just needs to get back to what it's good at, or used to be good at, just making planes and then figuring it out from there. All right. Before we move into, in case you missed it, the story is maybe not as popular on the website, we have another word from our sponsor, OEO.
At OEO Energy Solutions, we light your facility. OEO provides commercial and industrial LED lighting solutions and is a specialty supplier of both LED lamps and luminaires. As a leader in plug-and-play technology, OEO has developed the Easy LED lamp, which makes the conversion to LED fast and simple. OEO's direct replacement Easy LED lamps are designed to replace metal halide and high-pressure sodium bulbs. These lamps function with your existing ballasts, so that costly fixture replacement is not required, making your LED upgrade as simple as changing a light bulb. As an added benefit, the Easy LED hybrid technology also works on direct line voltage, providing you ultimate flexibility. OEO's other specialty products include LED fixtures designed for the harshest conditions, including high temperature manufacturing applications. Whether you're looking for LED lamps, high bay fixtures, office lighting, or outdoor area lighting, OEO has you covered. Contact OEO today for expert guidance on your next lighting project. OEO's knowledgeable team will make sure you have the right light for the right application. For all your lighting needs, visit OEO.com or call 1-800-553-2112. OEO Energy Solutions. Energy savings. Simplified.
This week's episode is brought to you by OEO. OEO's direct replacement easy LED lamps are designed to replace metal halide and high-pressure sodium bulbs. These lamps function with your existing ballasts so that costly fixture replacement is not required, making your LED upgrade as simple as... Producer Eric!
Changing a light bulb!
He nailed it from the back of the room! Whether you're looking for LED lamps, high bay fixtures, office lighting, or outdoor area lighting, OEO has you covered. OEO Energy Solutions. Energy savings simplified. I got to put this coffee away.
Put it down.
Let's move on to, in case you missed it, stories maybe not as popular, but, you know, could be a big deal. Anna, what do you have for us this week?
You have been overserved.
Right? I feel like so excited slash I could probably sleep right now.
In case you missed it, I selected this week's episode of our Gen Z in Manufacturing podcast titled How to Sell Welding to Gen Z, hosted by certified Gen Zer Nolan Beilstein of our crack team.
I was glad that you picked this one.
Yeah. I was drawn to this episode because it was about welding. And it featured a female welding professional named Deanna Bush Cutter. And I think it touches on not just being a young person in this field, but also being a young woman in this field, mm-hmm. which was fun to see. So she talked about her experience. She's now a community college welding instructor. And she actually got pretty candid. And I think it was a good example to other young people and other young women in the industry. And then a reminder, too, that I don't think you need to be like an older person to be a mentor.
Yeah.
She's, 27 years old, but she's, her experience, like, I think she did a great job, like, speaking to that group and making it identifiable. So one of my family members, he's 19 now. When he was 18, he got his welding certification while he was still in high school. Then when he graduated, he just was ready to go. Mm-hmm. And everyone in my family was just so impressed and proud of like what he had done. And I just think like the more you hear about like those opportunities that are out there, and when you see a young person talking about it, it's just so much more identifiable for those kids that are kind of coming up and saying like, oh, actually I could visualize myself doing that. If she's doing it, I could do it as a female, Mm-hmm. So, it was an impactful episode. I think it's a great series and we all agree. It's it's some stories that need to be told in an industry that's like, what do? We don't know how to recruit young people. Like watch the Gen Z in Manufacturing podcast. It'll maybe give you some good ideas, but.
No, I agree. I really like this episode because it caught me a couple of times in terms of like when Nolan was saying his next guest that he was interviewing was a welding teacher. And I was just like, how are they under 28 or 27 or whatever the threshold was?
Yeah.
And there were another, like in terms of being candid, I really liked some of the stories that she told in like terms of challenges she still faces, primarily with students that don't think she can weld mm-hmm. because she's a woman. And it's like she has to prove herself. Like when she walks up to people and says like, no, I can help you with that. Mm-hmm. And they kind of wait to see it to believe it. And I guess I was a little bit more optimistic in terms of thinking that maybe we had moved beyond that just because, I saw some of the struggles that my mother went through as, one of the first maintenance workers at a major chocolate manufacturing operation. And I guess I thought maybe because we were like 25 years removed from that, we'd come a little bit further. Mm-hmm. And we haven't. So let's work on that just in terms of accepting it. I was personally motivated.
Yeah.
Watching this one. And Jeff, we talk about it all the time. What do we need? Like 750,000 welding professionals in the next like 10 years? The stats are ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, for a while there, people were going away from this industry because we had a ton of them and they weren't paid the way they should have been. Then we have this huge shortage. And now to be a welder, not only is it a highly refined skill. I mean, if you ever tried to weld, it's hard
yeah.
to do it right and have it not look like basically don't know, you just threw a bunch of putty on something. I mean, yeah. it's difficult and it is an art. So the fact that there's such a demand for these workers right now and they're getting paid so well when they haven't been for quite a while is really cool to see.
Well, and she did a great job of talking about that as well. Like in terms of if you're a welder, you can make great money, but mm-hmm. it is going to be demanding. You're going to work 7 days a week. You're going to work incredible hours, but you're at least going to get paid for it. And I thought that was a really interesting or a good perspective to get that, you know, hey, if you want to just work your fingers to the bone, at least for a little bit, you can make some really good money out there. And if you don't, you can still make pretty decent money and, you know, have a good living with more of a, let's say, livable schedule. Mm-hmm. I thought this also lined up really well with Nolan had another story where he went to Miller in Appleton. They were showing off some new welding equipment and just to kind of show like how they're making it a little bit more accessible. You know, like Nolan welded something. I mean,
how bad was his welding?
I was going to say that had to be terrible.
It was welded. No, all right.
Nolan, I want to see pics or it didn't happen, Nolan. I want to see it.
We have a picture. We can pull it up.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But yeah, I mean, it was better than
I expected. Was this a robotic welder where he like pushed the button?
He pressed the button. Yeah. I mean, that's probably what happened.
Well, he put the mask on and then pushed the button.
Sounds about right.
What I meant to say was great job, Nolan.
It's a great, but this is a great, it's a great marriage of how like, you know, we always talk about how the tech coming into this industry too is something that could be a draw for Gen Z. Yeah. And I think like that story too, just showing, you know, it's not just a torch, you know, a torch and a helmet, you know, that's so much more advanced right now. Yeah. Jeff, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
So this is a little bit off the beaten path, but I thought this was interesting for a couple of different reasons. So I picked an article talking about how a Texas veterinarian helped crack the mystery of bird flu in cows. And if you read through this, at first, it's a little bit human interest, but then it definitely you can see the impact on manufacturing. So Barb Peterson, she's a vet working in the panhandle of Texas. She basically, for lack of a better term, sort of has a territory, if you will, where her responsibilities included herds of dairy cows of about 40,000 in total. Oh. And she started getting complaints about some really weird stuff going on. First, it was sort of like pigeons and other barnyard type birds. Then it was cats. Then there was some weird behaviors in the cattle, in the cows, where they weren't eating, they weren't milking properly, all this. So she did the due diligence, basically collected a ton of samples, did a lot of research on her own, but tested for everything. It wasn't just looking at the common source. Well, it's usually this stuff, and if it's not that, throw your hands up. I don't know what it is. No, she kept looking, kept searching again, finally got the results back showing that bird flu had somehow gotten into these cows and into these cats and actually even a couple of people. Ooh. In this area.
Ooh. Okay.
So now when we look at this and what she was able to sort of understand or at least get the origins of it, the CDC has now been on top of this and we've seen different stuff come out over the last couple of weeks. I mean, this is now not only the amount of poultry, looking over 90 million birds that were affected here, poultry that were on farms and stuff like that, 48 states, bunch of wild bird species, but also 9 states have had cattle outbreaks of bird flu. So a couple of different things here. Obviously, from a manufacturing perspective, this is going to impact a bunch of production, pricing, logistics, availability, all of that when it comes down to dairy products and beef. So it'll be interesting to see how we're able to deal with that and quell it. But it all really emanated from this woman not taking the typical route, looking further, investigating further, and really doing the due diligence to find the problem. We look at all these safety issues. We look at all these maintenance issues. Root cause analysis is something that we've talked about a lot, but maybe don't always pay attention to the extent that we should. And I think that was illustrated here. And as a result, we've got the source of the problem. We can go from there and trying to figure out a solution and probably saved a lot of farms in terms of from getting infected and preventing or at least trying to control the spread of bird flu right now.
Maybe part of the answer is more small and mid-size farming operations.
I'm with you there.
In a more competitive landscape.
Big production facilities, but larger, smaller farms. I agree.
Anna, this is kind of a really interesting story about how this particular vet was able to trace the root cause in kind of just in the long run, like a feel-good story.
Yeah, it was. One of the interesting things that was in the story, I thought, was they said that the reluctance of workers and farmers to allow testing is greatly hampering understanding of how the virus spreads, how large the outbreak is now, and how quickly it may grow, which is alarming. Mm-hmm. Again, like, you know, I think just as a widespread best practice is not exclusive to farming, but transparency and how important, I mean, as you mentioned, this had national implications of helping people understand how this was spreading and the, you know, what was happening here. There's always a benefit to sharing information when it comes to stuff like this. And so that reluctance needs to be addressed, I guess.
It is wild to me that we still want to play him so close to the vest, even when it comes to, you know, like a potential pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
All right. For my In Case You Missed It this week, I chose a story that came out, that broke yesterday, was published this morning. Microsoft is going to invest $3.3 billion to build a cloud computing and AI infrastructure in Wisconsin. So, like I said, Microsoft yesterday unveiled a huge deal to make Southeast Wisconsin a hub of the new AI economy. The investments include $3.3 billion in cloud computing and AI infrastructure, the first manufacturing-focused AI co-innovation lab in the U.S., and an AI skilling initiative to train more than 100,000 residents with essential AI skills. The plan is going to happen in four parts. First, the company is going to invest this $3.3 billion by the end of 2026 to expand national cloud and AI infrastructure capacity by developing a state-of-the-art data center campus in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. Why do we know Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin?
Sound familiar?
Right? It rhymes with MoxCon. In the second phase, Microsoft will build a manufacturing-focused AI co-innovation lab on the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus. It's going to be the first of its kind in the U.S., like I said, and the lab is going to connect Wisconsin manufacturers with Microsoft's AI experts. The hope is that by 2030, there are going to be at least 135 manufacturing businesses working as part of this lab. The third phase is going to see Microsoft partner with the United Way of Wisconsin and Racine and other community partners to upskill this 100,000 people across Wisconsin on how to use generative AI. And again, that's going to happen in the next 6 years as well. Finally, Microsoft is going to invest in long-term local education and youth employment programs. Now, I chose this story, well, because it's just great to get really excited about a potential investment from a tech company in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. But I just have, I got a better gut feeling that it's Microsoft and not Foxconn. I think it's an incredible opportunity. It's also a very clear plan with a very clear four-step approach to it in terms of how, I mean, we talk about it almost every week, like how are we going to make this new wave of AI technology possible in the United States when it's so power hungry, when it's so processing capacity hungry? And these are real solutions. And it's putting it in a place in Wisconsin that has kind of been like a bit of a stain ever since the eighth wonder of the world fell through. And I don't know, there were so many parts of this initiative that made sense. Like as I was reading it, I was just like, oh, okay, well, what are you going to do about labor? Oh, all right, you're going to tell people how to do it. Like, oh, but how are you going to teach them? Oh, you're going to partner with all these schools. So like, it just seems a lot more thought out, a lot less rushed than when we had the Foxconn deal come through. And I'm just hoping maybe it's a bit more successful, which isn't a high bar to clear, than the Foxconn deal. Jeff, did you see this news break from Microsoft and Mount Pleasant?
I did. And actually, you know, I think it's interesting. AI gets all the headlines.
Yeah.
But really, I think the more powerful part of this is the commitment to cloud computing.
Agreed.
Because I think that is what's going to be more further reaching in terms of from an everyday, more practical application, just because we're dealing with more and more data. It doesn't matter if it's here at work. I mean, look at the smart appliances and all the different data that can just be flowing around your home right now.
Yeah.
So I think that the ability to have some place to store all that information, access that information securely, safely, and in an easy way, I think that's really going to be a bigger part of this. But to combine it with AI, that gets a lot of headlines, gets people excited too. So great project, great place. I think before I even read it, I assumed that's where it was going to be because where else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If only they had a specific spot to meet this need, kind of half built. Yeah. No, but so to that point, Jeff, I agree. I think the AI is also part of you could have just said you're going to spend $3 billion to make a giant data center in Mount Pleasant. But like maybe that 0.3 million and all the other AI initiatives, maybe those tie in with a little bit more jobs just because a giant data center, I mean, outside of the like thousands of construction jobs that it creates in the interim, not the most don't need as many workers on site, you know?
Well, it's not as sexy sounding either. I mean, you still need a lot of people managing those data centers and obviously making sure everything's cool. And I mean, the amount of juice that's going in there is pretty incredible. So there is a lot of facilities management, but I get your point. Yeah,
and I'll talk about that juice in a second. Anna, what were your thoughts on the juice?
The juice part's exciting. I'll let you get to that. But okay. Yeah, I was, you know, I wonder if the people of Mount Pleasant who took like an absolute bath on this last deal, if they're going to feel better about the fact that it's Microsoft, just knowing that there's some like trustworthiness in that brand. I mean, I think it's a highly trusted brand and just knowing that this is far more likely to come through. Mm-hmm. I hope so, because that was such a horrible letdown for that community and they spent a ton of money developing that infrastructure and like basically went bankrupt, I think, their town. And so, you love to see the other side of it. I know when I saw the headline too, I was like scrolling down, like, please be Mount Pleasant, you know? And then, so that was exciting.
No. And honestly, if we could do it with only half the corruption, we should be all right on this one.
Sure. Yeah.
That's one thing I like about it being Microsoft too, is that it's a US based company. It's not a company that can just be like, didn't work and then leave. So talking about the juice, Microsoft also partnered with National Grid to build a new 250 megawatt solar project in Wisconsin that's going to begin operating in 2027. That seems ambitious, but maybe it will. The additional solar power means that by 2027, it's going to make enough power to service more than 3 million homes. This other point, though, really stood out to me because one of my biggest concerns with the Foxconn plant, the display manufacturing plants proposed, was how water hungry it was, right? Like we were talking millions of gallons that it was going to be drawing from Lake Michigan. And everyone else was just like, yeah, business first. And I'm just like, we need water, you know? So this new data center is going to use recycled water via a closed loop cooling system that doesn't require additional water after the startup. I thought that was huge. They did say that a relatively small portion of the facility is going to use water for cooling when it's kind of too hot outside, but nothing like the water requirements that we were seeing with the Foxconn deal. So I thought that was also important just because, you know, I love the Great Lakes and I'd like to see them as
full of water as possible.
Full of water, less toxic as possible, you know, maybe not drinkable, but, you know, close. All right. Well, let's move into our final thoughts. But before we get out of here this week, Anna, what's your final thought?
My husband and I have been car shopping over the last few weeks, and we had an interesting conversation with one of the people at the dealership, we were talking about like some of the features on one of the vehicles, and he was there's all these features right now in these new vehicles, and it's just like kind of overwhelming. And the one that he drilled down on was not a feature that he liked. It was a feature that he didn't like. And it was how his cup holder would crush his Starbucks cup because it was so tight that by the time he would get to work, his bottom of his cup would be like folded in.
Okay.
And it just made me laugh because, you know, we talk about over-engineering sometimes on this podcast. And I just thought it was just like a funny illustration of that, to think that this person who works in the auto industry, that is like the most memorable thing about that vehicle for them is this cup holder that drives them nuts every single day.
Yeah.
What a strange thing to get wrong in a vehicle, you know, when there's all these features and bells and whistles and stuff. So anyway, just that as a quick thought to think about, like maybe some of the stuff that we have now may not be as necessary as like perfecting the things that we do use on a regular basis. I don't know.
Well, I mean, and you had a similar situation, right? Where you had that that backup sensor on, you recently had a rental that had a backup sensor and they like didn't engineer it for anyone backing out of a driveway at a slight angle.
With any sort of grade. So every single time I would back it out, even though my driveway is like very slight grade, it thought I was going to like run over a person or I don't know. It thought the road was a person. And like, so it would like jam on the brakes, make like alarm. So it was like with the kids, I was like, okay, the alarm's going to go off. Like we could finally, I figured out Eric helped me figure out how to turn that feature off. Mm-hmm. But again, it's like, that was a workaround of a safety feature. Like, you know, you don't want to be turning that stuff off, but at the same time, like it was like very disruptive and I, you know, jamming on the brakes when I'm trying to get out of my driveway.
Yeah.
So I would turn it off just to get out of my driveway and then I would turn it back on. But again, you know, yeah, some of these things where you're like, this is a very basic function of this vehicle and it doesn't function very well. Yet I can like open my tailgate by just like brushing the badge on the back or whatever, you know, like this is some of the stuff where you're just like, do I really need that? No.
Yeah. It can like read your thoughts. Like,
yeah,
it knows that you're coming with groceries and just opens.
Yep.
No, it is, you know, sometimes when we're designing or building a better mousetrap, we need to make sure that it still catches mice.
Yeah.
My final thought this week is that this week is Teacher Appreciation Week. So by the time that most of you listen to this, it'll be over. But it doesn't mean that you can't show appreciation for the teachers that are helping our kids and our schools thrive. And it's kind of upsetting that it only happens 1 week out of the year. But one thing I will say is that I've been really encouraged by, you know, they just do a couple of events every day for the teachers and just the amount of support that, you know, it could just be specific to our community. People have shown these teachers has been really encouraging. And I just, you know, when there is a Teacher Appreciation Week, you know, use that to show your support for the teachers that are helping us out. But it doesn't have to be limited to this week. Like, it is amazing how if you bring just like a baker's dozen bagels to like a teacher's lounge, how they think you're like the second coming. They're just like, he brought bagels. It's like, we need to support you more. But I don't know. I think that we should do more for the teachers out there. I think that they are kind of a marginalized profession right now, and they're more important than ever. So love them and appreciate them, and do what you can. Jeff, your final thoughts this week?
So I was hesitant to bring this up because it could definitely take us down a wormhole. But
nice.
Anyway, so I told you I was at that cybersecurity conference last Thursday, talked a lot about AI. And one of the things that was brought up, and I can't remember the name of this theory, but it has a specific name. But the thought is the fact that we're developing artificial intelligence validates the fact that there is extraterrestrial life.
Oh.
Because the thought is humanity, any type of, or not humanity, any type of organized society is doomed to destroy itself.
Oh.
So the fact that we're developing artificial intelligence at the rate that we are shows that there were probably other societies that did this before us from other galaxies, planets, whatever you want to say, but they're not around anymore.
And inevitably destroyed themselves?
Right.
Oh, because man! Of AI. You should have texted me immediately. I would have been down the road so fast. Whew, that is a hard one. So like, yeah.
This is an uplifting way to end.
Yeah,
Jeff.
Was the person that was presenting on this just like, was this like the closer? Just like, all right, no, have a good
he was more, it was, again, the overarching theme was AI is here. It's good. We can use it. It's not the end of the world. Like,
it doesn't sound like the overall
theory he was valid. He just threw it out there as this is what some people think.
Yeah.
And then his counterpoint was, I disagree for all of these reasons. Yeah. We are a long way from StarNet, you know?
Man, that is wild.
Yeah.
I would just,
well, it just kind of illustrates how people can grab a lot of different things and try to kind of hodgepodge them together to validate what they want to think about. In my opinion, if you feel that way, you're entitled to, but that seemed kind of out there to me.
Also, like, we can destroy our humanity in like many, many other ways. Like, it doesn't have to be AI.
We've actually been like doing our part over the course of the last like 100 years or so. We've been really, just like, ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've just really ramped it up.
We have kicked it into high gear.
But like you said, that's not what's going to happen. Right. Even though, hypothetically, according to this person who had 5 minutes in a wild imagination, has decimated previous alien races before.
No, he said that was just, I mean, there's other elements of this theory, yeah. But that's one of the parts of it. I thought it was funny.
Yeah, no,
it was funny.
It started with like OT vulnerabilities and some like foreign planet. We need to talk about this more. All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email any of us, you can reach us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily newsletter. Subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can join us when we go live every Thursday at 2 p.m. For Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.